Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's Great Conversation is the second part of a panel discussion that I held on Queer Stories, a collection of writing from some of Australia's finest LGBTQIA+ writers. Now, the panel features Liz Duck-Chong, Tim Bishop, and the editor of the collection, Maeve Marsden. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I speak with Australian writers and we explore their books, their writing, the literary culture that informs them. And I broadcast this from Final Draft, the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Now, this Great Conversations podcast, it expands that discussion. I get to play you the full interviews and really we get behind the scenes of the book. And we explore the way that it connects with the world and the pressing issues that we deal with every day. Thanks everyone who has been enjoying the podcast. You've shared it, you've subscribed, you've liked it and given us a rating. If you haven't done that yet, please think about giving us a rating and subscribing so that others can find the podcast. Now, as I said, this is the second part of the Queer Stories panel. And Queer Stories features a diverse collection of Australia's LGBTQIA+ writers, and it explores their lives and their experiences. I'm really excited to share this second part where we really get into what storytelling means and identity. So join me now and the fabulous group of writers exploring storytelling, community, and the need to listen openly in Queer Stories. So coming at it as a reader... And I mean, I guess that's really my role here. I'm someone who's read it.
Yeah.
You're all involved in it.
I've read it too.
Confession. I don't know if you guys have a particular philosophy on reading short stories or collections. I am a bouncer. Some people swear by sort of a linear reading, but I bounce.
Interesting.
And because I was familiar, because you know, you all have platforms, so I was aware of your from Twitter and. And so I have various familiarity with different writers. So I did things like searched out the writers that I knew I'd enjoyed before. But I learned really quickly. So Tim, I wasn't as familiar with you.
Sure.
But I learned really quickly with each of the stories to expect the tears to come. there are moments. I mean, I think it's devastating in that it's only the second or third paragraph where you say after my partner had died.
Sure.
And I wasn't expecting that, and it was just so beautifully. I don't know. It devastated me. That was all I had to say there. But what did you gain from reading each other's? You have read at least some, if not all of them. Maybe you've obviously been there for all of them.
I mean, the thing about the devastation, I think, is really interesting. Putting the order together, I found that quite hard because they really do jump around. Between quite devastating and quite hilarious. And I read something recently that said the art of queer storytelling, it was talking about Nanette, Hannah Gadsby's show, and it was talking about how the art of queer storytelling is being able to switch very quickly from the seriously tragic to the comic, and that it's a coping mechanism for those from marginalised communities as well to do dark humour. And that sort of relieved some of my stress. For me, the order in my head takes a person through a life. So a lot of them start with, a lot of the earlier stories are around childhood or coming out, not perfectly like that because I didn't want it to be too obvious. And by the end, you've got a lot more stories that I think are, a heavier reflection on death or introspection. So, but that was loosely done as a shape.
So I'm sorry, I've completely blown
you've ignored it.
Your curation.
No, but that's good because I was so worried about whether it was perfect. And somebody said to me, people jump around with short stories, calm down, just do it in an order that feels right to you. I've read all of them, but it's hard for me because I've read them first as drafts. I saw them performed. I edited them for the podcast, or I had someone edit them for the podcast, and then edited them for this. And then at a certain point read the proofs, and it's hard for me sometimes now to remember them as stories, but some of the beautiful moments I had while editing the book was when a story like Tim's had me cry again, and I was like, well, I've read this so many times and I'm sitting at my desk technically doing work, but I can still laugh or cry or respond to these stories like a reader, and that was really delightful in terms of a day at work.
I should have clarified too. I mean, I used Tim. I mentioned yours as an example, but I found myself at these different moments, like there were tears were joyful and also sad. There's There's so much, and I mean,
hilarity.
Yeah.
There's one story that I just laughed. The South Australia with the pinball.
Jen Clowes.
That was so beautiful.
And as a reader, one of the things I sort of noticed. I suppose I haven't read many anthologies of different writers, was the thing about how, you know, style kept changing, which understandably, you know, it does. So I enjoyed it. You're talking about it as a reader, you know, read a couple or read one, have a think about it, even Google the writer, you know, and see what they look like. I wanted to find out who exactly they were. And,
I recently was writing my second piece for Queer Stories, and I was having, like, as I do before everything I write, I was having just a massive brain block, and I was like, I can't write. I have no idea what I'm doing. This is a ridiculous career. And so I decided to, like, read the entire book and listen to the entire podcast as a way to just, like, prep myself to get in the mood. And I just spent, like, several days catatonic, just, like, so full of emotion I couldn't do anything, because I'm just like, I love my community so much. Everyone is so wonderful. Like, I just could, like, my, like, partners and friends were just like, are you okay? I'm just like, I just love everyone. Like, there's so much emotion in them.
There is so much emotion in them. And I think that the more of them that get done, the easier it is for writers who come to speak at Queer Stories to get a sense of the style, that it's a space for the personal and the intimate and for laughing at yourself and laughing at the community as well. That it's a space where we can make fun of our community is also great, because we can't always do that in a public-facing way. And I think that what's nice about this collection for me is that it happened before some of that rhythm had really settled in. Like, if you think about the life of a book, these are all from kind of the first year of Queer Stories, when we were still working out what the event was, sort of collectively. And I think that that diversity of style is really reflected in the book. And I mean, if there's a second volume, which I would love there to be, I think that would be different again.
Can I ask all of you then, and I don't know why this is only just occurring to me, when I received the book, and when I first heard the book, when I received it, I was aware of the evening, but I didn't know whether it was all personal stories. I thought perhaps there could be some elements of fiction or something, but I mean, I suppose it's not beyond the realm of possibility that you could do that. But what the question I have is, what is a queer story then?
It's 10 minutes of an LGBTQI+ person telling a personal story. I say no fiction. Telling a personal story in whatever style they wish. I say to people, it's a lot of what I do is just a few boundaries of what it's not, because I don't want to be too prescriptive. I say I don't want spoken opinion pieces. I really don't want a political speech. Politics is integral to our lives, but I really don't want a style that would get published as an opinion piece in a magazine. I think we've read a lot of those, and it's not what the night is for. And I don't want fiction. And other than that, it's the identity of the person that makes the story. And it's hard. I have to, because I'm a bit of a bossy boots and a writer myself, I have to curb myself from being too heavy-handed with either boundaries or editing. Mm-hmm. I edit if there's content that's offensive, or I provide advice if I think the writer's a bit in the weeds with their piece, or if they've written something too long. But I'm pretty open with what people are allowed to do. People sometimes use projection, like they have a slideshow of photos from their life. I've never told people to do that, but some people just want to. People sometimes incorporate music. We did one with 78ers, who are all people who marched in the first Mardi Gras protest, and heaps of them went to really high tech, so smashing through that stereotype of old people and tech, because they were like, one of them had this incredibly complex PowerPoint with like pop songs that took ages to edit out of the podcast because we didn't have the rights to the pop songs. So people sometimes get really creative with their 10 minutes or sing, but normally it's a personal narrative story delivered in the style of lots of the ones in the book.
So once Maeve's given you that rundown and told you more that it's sort of what it's not. What is it then to you? I mean, if you think
challenging.
So open-ended.
And, you know, you get full of fear of expectations, like, you know, because I came late to Queer Stories. It was new to me.
Yeah.
One of the things I really had to deal with was this expectation of humour, that like we need it, and it's but sort of like, oh gee, you know, sort of like, I know they sort of, you know, they're expecting, I feel like they're expecting humour, but they're not. And I suppose that was more because of Giant Dwarf and you know, and the history of the place as, you know, as comedy. So, you know, as a performer, you know, you start to get your natural fears about, you know, oh, you know, what am I going to write? You know, what do they want?
A lot of people have that humour concern. They say, do they need to be funny? Do they need to be funny? And I say, no, just write what you want. No. And often people write sad stuff and the humour comes in them going off script spontaneously. Yeah. But my job, I think, is often creating an order for the night that protects the storytellers. So not putting someone incredibly funny before someone devastatingly sad, if that person is less, especially if that person's less experienced. So I try in the shape of the night to create a rhythm that means that the audience will go with the stories. So even the last Friday that we were speaking of, where I knew that sort of two or three of the stories were quite personal and could be end up feeling sad on the night, and even that night I switched to on arrival because I realized that the energies they were bringing to the room were going to work better in a different order, and sometimes it's about starting with something sad so people are ready for the sad that comes later. Sometimes it's about starting really light so that people are buoyed and then can stay up. So the order for me is really important of each individual event, in terms of protecting people and their individual writing styles.
And it's a comment that comes up a lot from a lot of people I talk to, that the events are incredibly well programmed. Like that comes through so well in how the audience are receiving that.
I want to enter a sort of a realm of what storytelling does, what sort of power storytelling has, because it's something that we do as from a very young age. In fact, something I'll share about me, my day job, I'm a speech pathologist.
Oh, cool.
And so I work with kids, some of my littlies, I think the littlest I've had was about 15 months.
Oh.
And looking at how they develop language and then into narrative and the way narrative realizes self. And I'm really curious about that juxtaposition between telling these personal stories and then the idea of archetypes and narratives that you are meant to fit into. And Maeve, you mentioned in My Mother's Told Me Stories, this need to explain, to justify your family, also this this pressure to be like exemplary queers. Mm. And I think you felt it particularly for your family because before they split up, your mothers had been together, was it 28 years?
28 years, and they were kind of trailblazers. I'm 34, my brother's 37 or 38, and my sister's 3 years younger. And when they came to Sydney in 88, there wasn't a sort of coherent lesbian mothers with children group or rainbow babies, and they started the first one here. So most of our family friends who had kids and were queer families, the kids were younger than us, which wasn't the case in London. In London, there was a big cohort our age. So they were trailblazers and there was that pressure. I mean, I think the storytelling thing is really interesting. I think for me it's been a double-edged sword in that I can't imagine my life without having been this person who spoke about themselves a great deal, and it is now part of my career and I'm confident on stage in part as a result. So I don't regret that pressure, but I also, as discussed with my therapist, have quite a lot of anxiety and perfectionism around performing the self and around that. I mean, I think what you say about toddlers is really interesting though, because I read that actually when toddlers are repeating these stories, they're actually creating the neural pathways of understanding in their brain. It's not that they're just repetitive and don't have more language. When they tell you the same thing over and over again, they're teaching themselves cause and effect, and they're teaching themselves how the world works. And that fascinated me and made me much more patient with my younger kids, friends' kids, when they want to repeat things. Because I was like, this is them understanding the world. We tell stories to understand the world.
And I pushed the speech pathologist in me down because
I love speech pathologists.
We will go on such a weird tangent.
But I'm into it. A speech pathologist changed my life. I had nodules and a speech pathologist retaught me how to sing and I now have a career as a singer. I love speech pathologists.
Wow.
You said that and I was like, yay, a hero.
What I was wondering about your story though is in one sense you talk about how there was a sense that you had sort of the perfect story in your family, and then it even you know, close friends were struggling with this idea that your parents were splitting up and the perfect story was over, I got a sense that you felt like there was a letting down. And
there was a total letting down.
What did storytelling and telling that story do to you to sort of honour your story and to realise yourself?
Look, it's been interesting. It's been interesting working through the writing of my story where I talk about my parents' divorce, or quote-unquote divorce. It was interesting processing it with my parents and saying to them, I'm going to start writing about our family in different ways, because they're used to me writing really positive things about our family, especially, I mean, man, during that plebiscite, everyone wanted me to write a happy gaby story, and I made a reasonable income doing it a few times. And I mean it. I was a happy child. Like, I'm glad my parents stayed together, even though it was hard for them sometimes, because I did have a pretty happy and supported childhood by them. But in them splitting up, and in them splitting them up with a lot of fighting and lies and issues between them, putting that to paper and, I suppose, outing them for some of their flaws or shortcomings was hard for them, for me to do that. But I'm only able to do it because that family tradition of storytelling and processing has gone on for the 10 years after they split up. So that trait that they gave me of talking and communicating, we have applied to our family, and their belief in our family and possibly their strength fighting against discrimination has made them reshape our family. So by the time I've put the story down, by the time I've said, I think I say they're total dickheads, a line that they did not like, but I left in because it was true for me. By the time I put that down, they were ready for me too, I think. And I've told them I'm already, I want to write a play about a same-sex couple getting divorced. And I've started working on that. So they're going to get used to it. If your family's weird and difficult, you should at least get an arts career out of it, surely.
But I think one of the things we've touched on a lot is the idea that it's really, it's not just therapeutic. Like I have also talked to my therapist about my stories, as I'm sure a bunch of people have. But there's something really therapeutic about talking about our flaws and our foibles and the ways that we completely fuck up as queers, and that isn't allowed to be part of the public narrative. Like, the op-eds are like, everything is perfect and beautiful and here's why, and to be able to get onto a stage and be like, sometimes it's not, and have people be like, yeah, like, absolutely it's not, is
and
a really,
we hurt each other, it's not just discrimination from outside. We need to be able to talk about what a community of people who've gone through discrimination and in many cases trauma, what that means when we all band together. Sometimes we hurt each other. I mean, racism in the LGBTQI+ community is a real problem, and especially because there's less of us, so we're all thrown in together, so we're experiencing those lateral discriminations in really fraught ways. And we have to be able to talk about that now. We can't just keep saying, everything's fine, we're great, we're just like you, we're normal, we're the same, love us. Because we've got to process some stuff first. And I think stories are a gentle way of doing that. Stories are a welcoming way of doing that.
And everyone kind of gets in on it. Like, whenever in the room someone's like, oh, here's like, you know, something terrible that has happened to me or happened by another queer, everyone's just like, yes, yeah. That experience. And right. So there's kind of a sharing about it.
Yeah.
You're looking at me.
Oh, or I was maybe we can talk about how we got to this point where we have this need for people to be exemplary. Because it was only a month ago, although everything in Oz politics feels like a lifetime, it was only a month ago that Scott Morrison tweeted his ridiculous gender whispering comments. So I was in a coffee shop just the other day. It was yesterday, actually. Up the back, they had this play area, and it was resplendent with, like, it had a miniature espresso machine assorted little wooden petit fours. So the kids were happily playing barista. Not a single parent was in an uproar about the cafe being hospitality whisperers. What does stories? I mean, and kids play. Kids play, and they go through, you know, they go through copying play, and they go through scripting of things that they've seen and trying on different ideas of what it means to do a thing. What do stories in queer stories, or being able to tell queer stories, like, you know, let's separate queer stories in the book and on the stage to queer stories being told everywhere. What do stories and having them visible, lived queer experiences and realities, mean to you? And what do you think they mean to kids out there who are living in a society that has a prime minister that still engages, content warning, in this kind of fucking hateful commentary? Like, what does it mean, or what would it have meant to you?
I'm just thinking.
Yeah,
which way in?
Yeah, yeah. Look, the only thing I can sort of pick up is the idea is when you're giving out your story, you're hoping or wishing that it resonates with someone. Like, it won't resonate necessarily as equally with everybody, but for somebody, it sort of resonates. And then that can oppose, you know, the other messages that, you know, they're hearing. It's about almost, you know, changing your thinking. Like, you know, once you hear the story, you could, you know, if you it resonates with you, you can change, you know, the way you feel about yourself or you
I think for me
yourself.
The thing with children and those sort of comments from good old ScoMo, someone said that sounds affectionate, ScoMo, and I think it sounds like scum or ScoMophobe, so I'm keeping it.
It sounds like an eczema sort of
it
thing.
It does, doesn't it, right? The thing about children, and I'm at that age where most of my close friends or a lot of my close friends and relatives are having kids, so I'm around children a lot, and you realise what sponges they are, and that if you give them positive content or stories around gender, they will pick it up. They are not naturally split into pink and blue. They're these beautiful little creatures who blur those lines, and all the teaching we do to them that locks them into this kind of cishet set two camps, you know, boys and girls can't be friends, that... That's what's damaging. I really think it is. And then whether they're or not they're queer or straight, at a certain point they're going to have to undo it. Straight couples now are trying to work out how to dismantle everything we were taught growing up about men and women being each other's enemies and needing to line up in separate lines, because then they've got to find ways to love each other. In some ways, I think lesbianism looks much easier than being a heterosexual woman these days, because the whole world is debating, you know, the way that men and women can love and desire each other. It's exhausting, and it's because we do this to kids. It's because we lock them in to these camps and set them up as this battle. And I think it's harmful. I spent the weekend with my 3-year-old niece, who is not being raised without gender, but her parents are putting a huge amount of effort to not gender people all the time. So they talk about adults and kids, not boys and girls and men and women. They say, oh, look, that adult over there is doing that. And the delight in seeing her discover gender and try to work it out, but without any rules. You know, she said about her little brother, he's a boy and I'm a kid. And then her mum was like, well, he's going to be a kid too. Oh, no, he's a boy. I'm a kid. And so she's still working out. She's like, he's a boy because he's got a penis. And her mother just said, well, he might be, or he might choose to be a girl one day. And some, you know, a lot of boys have penises. And she was like, I'm a boy. And she said, and I was like, if you want, yeah, you wanted to be a boy yesterday. So if you want to be a boy today, you can. She said, no, I'll be a girl. And that's what kids do. And if you don't challenge it and you just let them play with it and you let them play with all the toys and do all the things, they'll work it out. They don't actually need to be taught these rigid roles. And actually teaching them, I think, is harmful, because imaginative play, like you were saying, is how, and stories is how kids learn. And if you just always go, cool, instead of don't touch that, you're a boy and that's a girl's toy. I mean, I'm going on about it, but it bothers me. And when you see it done well, when you see kids given all the options to be free and to be themselves, they generally pick somewhere in the middle for years. And why not let them have that? Let them have that freedom from those rules that kind of lock us in.
At the Queer Stories book launch at the Opera House, it was really interesting that a lot of people came up with two books to get signed, and one was like for them and the other one was for like a child, like a niece or a nephew or a nibbling, or like some, like a friend's kid or someone in their life who they either knew was queer or maybe assumed was queer, or just wanted to give the book. And they just wanted, you know, can you write something inspiring for them, can you do something in this book for, like, you know, this 10-year-old child, this 15-year-old child. And that was a really beautiful thing that so many people, including like a lot of, like a bunch of straight parents, it seemed, was just like, this is clearly important that they're reading this, that they're engaging with this. And I want to provide them this. I want to actually give them the stories that they can go out into the world with. And I mean, I think that's one of the really beautiful things about the idea of Queer Stories is, like, you know, the book is called Queer Stories, the event's called Queer Stories, but it's coming from a concept that is that we all do it anyway. Like, queer stories are a thing that everybody has and owns in the community, and that kids are able to do that. Like, what kids are doing now are their own queer stories. And like, we don't have a, you know, a trademark on what that means for us as performers and adults and writers. Mm. Like, it's a thing that everybody does all the time, and it's how we build community.
Yeah.
And I think as well, I mean, I noticed it as well. I just did events in Lismore and Albury, and at both events, straight parents bought some LGBTQI teens and sort of checked in advance that it was okay to bring like 15 to 18 year olds. And they did, and they came up afterwards, and it was beautiful. And that doesn't happen so much in Sydney because there's more options for everyone in terms of events. But these parents living in rural towns, and we've got so many stereotypes about rural towns and homophobia, but they were really stepping up and really trying. This gruff dad, who I thought was a bear, but it turns out he was a straight dad who'd brought his trans boy teen, who was about 16, 17, and he was working really hard to get the gender right, you know, and he could be like, it's good for him to see his community, and he wanted to come and talk to you, and like, that wouldn't have happened 10, 15 years ago. Like, things are changing, and I think that Prime Minister and government who say those kind of things, they're actually behind, like they're further behind the parents who are trying harder. And, you know, I mean, yeah, my sister-in-law who's not doing gender too much with her kid, she's in a straight relationship. Like, these are people really wanting their kids to have all the options, and it's exciting. Like, it's not what I had. I mean, I had it in my house growing up, but once I left the walls of my house, there was a lot of gender crap. Mm.
It's wonderful to read. It's also really challenging and really difficult, because the one thing that you don't get growing up, and you get a lot when you're white and you're male, you're cisgendered male and you're heterosexual.
There's heaps of you on telly.
You get, The one thing you don't get is told that you're still performing as well. You're still performing a role. And so to read something like Queer Stories, you start to see all the different potentialities. Mm. And so that's hard, because you have to challenge yourself. And like, that's an active thing that you have to do. And so that's wonderful. So I'm going to say thank you to all of you.
Oh, thanks.
This is Final Draft. You are on 2SER 107.3. And I've been having a wonderful conversation. I'm going to reintroduce, shocking, I haven't reintroduced you during our long conversation, but I am speaking with Liz Duck-Chong, Tim Bishop and Maeve Marsden. We are discussing Queer Stories, which is an absolutely fantastic collection. You have to get out and read it. I'm telling you.
Buy it.
Yeah. Mm. Or you can come and borrow mine, but there'll be a line.
No, buy it.
You've got to go and buy your own. Thank
we'll
you.
Go to a library.
Thank each of you for coming in.
No
thank
worries.
You so thank, much. You.
Thank you.
That's it for part two of our Great Conversations panel discussing Queer Stories. It's a new collection exploring lives well lived from some of Australia's finest LGBTQIA+ writers. Today's panel featured Liz Duck-Chong, Tim Bishop and Maeve Marsden. And Queer Stories is out now through Hachette. Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER's Broadway Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. If you're enjoying Great Conversations from Final Draft, please subscribe and give us a rating wherever you're listening to the podcast. Not only will you receive a new episode delivered straight to your phone every week, or as the case may be this week, two new episodes, it also is a great way to help others discover Australian literature through the podcast. 2SER is a community radio station, and we're supporter funded. If you like our podcast and you want to be part of that community, you can support us on 2SER.com/support. To keep up with the latest books, writing and literary culture, why not follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook? We are Final Draft, or at Final Draft, 2SER. I'm Andrew Popel, and I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. See you then.